You're listening to Mentoring Developers, the podcast for you if you are a new developer or if you want to be a developer. This is episode 78.
Welcome to Mentoring Developers, the podcast for new and aspiring software developers, where we discuss your struggles, anxieties, and career choices. And now, here's your host, Arsalan Ahmed.
Hi, everyone. Welcome again to Mentoring Developers. Now, this is a podcast where you learn about what you need to do to succeed in this world of software development and IT. And today we have a great panel. We have Warner Moore and Kevin Mack. We're going to talk about what technology choices you need to be looking at in this year, 2020 and beyond, if you want to succeed. And first time on this show, we have a new guest, Warner.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here with both of you today. And always great talking about stuff like this. My background is in technology and cybersecurity. I've spent the bulk of my career working with startups and growth companies, taking companies from maybe concept stage really early all the way up to growth stage. Based here in Columbus, Ohio, a lot of folks know CoverMyMeds. That was a company I helped build in town here. So between my background between technology and cybersecurity, I founded a cybersecurity strategy consulting firm called Gamma Force. We're two as of July. And really what we like to do is help companies look at what they're doing and how they can be innovative with technology, applying things like DevOps culture and practices, or help use cybersecurity to actually drive their business as opposed to slow it down. So with that, I tend to serve in fractional executive roles, virtual CISO, CIO, CTO type of roles. I'm CISO for a couple organizations right now. In addition to that, I do a lot in the community. I'm super passionate about hanging out with smart folks like you. And a good way to do that is organize. And between that, I founded a group here in Columbus called Lapsa Columbus. Go figure, right? And we're a chapter for a professional organization for infrastructure and operations professionals. Additionally, I was a founding organizer of DevOps Days Columbus. I'm on the board and conference chair for Ohio Linux Fest. We're a nearly 20-year-old conference that's focused on free and open source technologies and applying those professionally. So a really varied background, but looking forward to getting nerdy with you guys here today.
Awesome. And we also have Kevin Mack. You've seen, if you've been watching the show, you know Kevin, but give us your introduction anyway.
Yeah, so my name is Kevin Mack, and I'm happy to be back. Did not mean to rhyme, but it's a honor to be here, especially with Warner. I've known Warner for now many years, and I've always been impressed by his work he's done here in the Central Ohio, really across all of Ohio, for organizing events and furthering education for developers, and really, like, not just, you know, getting people to become organizers, but then also supporting organizers. So it's awesome to be here with Warner and you. So
awesome.
But for myself, I'm a developer, I'm a designer, have worked in various roles inside of digital, but really focus on custom application development and creating large scaling applications. So wide range of experience, knowledge, and worked in way too many types of technologies.
All right. So perfect guests for this discussion. We're going to discuss if technology choices you need to make if you're just starting out. So if you're just starting out, let's start with Warner. If I am somebody who is a freshman in college, maybe I have a computer science degree or major, computer science major, or maybe I don't, or maybe I'm in high school, or maybe I'm somebody who's been working somewhere, maybe at Kroger for a couple of years, and I feel like, yeah, maybe I can get into tech, but I don't know where to start, what to learn. There are thousands of things. How would you advise that person?
Well, With a mentoring conversation, I always like to understand the person, right? What have you done? Where have you been? Where are you going? Somebody who is passionate about building things or working in specific areas, it's always easy. Conversation I had with a young man earlier this year, he liked building tangible things. A lot of the work I've done tends to be intangible, software, software as a service company, stuff like that. But this gentleman really liked building things, so microelectronics and things like that. And I spent a lot of time talking with him about where the companies were doing the things that were driving the industry in the area where he liked to focus. So I can certainly talk generally. If we're talking somebody new into technology and just really passionate about applying it, I usually think of what a lot of the younger companies are doing, what a lot of the leading developers and engineers are doing. If we think about what a lot of technologies that have gotten a lot of traction in recent history, Ruby, for example, I remember 10 years ago when it was the cool thing we just like to hack around with, but a big reason why it got so much adoption in companies is because it's what we like to use.
Right.
So I think we have a lot of power. Early in a career, it helps to know where your passion is and then align your skill set to the things that the companies are using in the areas where you're passionate, though.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and can I say something? Because yep. Warner and like the decisions that they made at CoverMyMeds is actually why we use Rails, so Ruby at Vibe, and some of the other products and other startups in town that I've been an advisor, mentor, and help them plan out their architecture. It's because they created literally like an army of Rails developers. And it's like absolutely crazy what they've done. Like I remember there were billboards. So there's this huge building off of 315, which is one of our main highways that cuts downtown Columbus. And on this big billboard, it was like, learn Ruby. And it said, cover my meds or something along the lines of that. And it created this movement for that language. And they created literally an army of developers. And it's just funny because when that started, I know when CoverMyMeds was getting started, it started off, I think it was in Linux, or not Linux, Python. And then it switched to Rails at a later time. And then literally wherever you turned, that sign was there. They were recruiting, they were training, they were making these devs. And to this day, it has become the core technology for majority of startups here in Columbus. It's been like, you know, there was .NET to decide from like the corporate side or the Java side at different banks. But then CoverMyMeds, who's now one of the biggest companies in Columbus, started this Rails like movement. It, absolutely amazing. It influences majority of my decisions today.
Yeah, that's a very good point. But I will also say that that Ruby on Rails has been popular for many years on the West Coast and also on the East Coast. So a lot of, I would say 10 years ago, as Warner is mentioning, 10 years ago, if you wanted to start a company, a tech company, you would first go to Ruby on Rails. 10 years ago, that was a hot thing, even 5 years ago. Now, maybe that's not the case. But if I wanted to lay it out, the lay of the land for somebody, because, okay, they hear Ruby on Rails, they hear Node.js, they're going to hear lots of things, but they don't know where to place them. So if I wanted to make a map of the technology landscape, so we can talk about... you know, what are the different buckets that we can create or different continents in this map of this technology world? So I'm going to go with corporate type things where generally you're not that concerned about some kind of fluid user interfaces, but you're concerned about logic and security and safety and understandability and wide reach and whatever you can say. But then I would say this is like the corporate continent over there, and there's a country called .NET over here, there's a country called Java over here, and I can maybe name a few others. And then on this side, there's the kind of the short-lived application space where you're building a lot of small applications to prove a point, maybe what we call a minimum viable product, that kind of a thing. Then use the other type of thing where in the middle somewhere where you're not making throwaway applications, but at the same time you want to make full stack apps, what they're called. You want to be able to handle everything, but you want to use some kind of patterns, you know, fast iteration, rapid application development, all of these terminology that I've heard all my life. And I don't want to overwhelm the viewers and the listeners here, but I think it would be good to know you could do this, or you could focus on this, or you could focus on this, or you could focus on that. And then within that, we can say, this is where we think the future is in this world over here versus this continent over here. What do you think?
Well, yeah, totally. I mean, that's really why I grounded first in where's your passion, right? If your passion is CRUD applications for yeah. banks and insurance companies, Java and C-sharp's the way to go, right? all these technologies are being applied to solve different problems, and they all work. There isn't a wrong answer.
Right.
There might be a wrong answer depending on what somebody wants to do.
Well, and something like, so I brought up the Cover My Meds and, you know, them creating this army and the signs and the training for it. When you look at the corporate world, I think why like the C-sharp, .NET, Java world is so popular is because that's what you're learning in school. So if you're getting a computer science degree, that's what they're teaching in school. Now, I know there are some classes now that are getting into like Node and some of the newer technologies. Well, newer technologies, they're now like 10 years old, but for school, college curriculum, it's relatively new. And I think it's the same idea of like creating this army, and they have more people to pick from. So corporate world isn't as willing to maybe try a new technology out. This is purely based off of, you know, my own experiences in it. You want to pick a technology that is stable and that there's a lot of developers out there that you can pick from. So you can get a handful of college students' resumes or people that have worked in that in consulting firms. There's a bigger ocean to pull from when it comes to those. And I think that's why corporate does that. But I think there's this fear about picking a new technology that may not exist and going to like getting, you know, face down learning everything about another technology that isn't Java or something that's being taught in college. It does have that question mark, is who's actually hiring for it. Even though I'm passionate about a certain technology, a certain language, there may not be someone hiring in my market. And that's kind of like, yeah, follow your passion. And especially when you're learning, find the language that you're most excited about. But then if you're trying to make a career, you also have to like weigh and balance out the two. Like, even sure. though I'm passionate about Node, are there jobs in our Columbus market for me to get my first job in Node? And so like those things have to come out.
Not passionate about technology per se, like Node or Java. I'd suggest how it's being applied, industries, creating certain things, because in SaaS companies, right, we see a lot of free and open source tech, be it Node, Ruby, Elixir, Go, Python. They all have traction and folks use them. They exist in the corporate world, but less commonly. Somebody who likes working in embedded systems right. might actually be coding in NCC still, right? Yes and no. With IoT, it's changed a bit, the abstraction. So I agree 100% with your point. So more just clarifying in that I think passion about a specific technology can be a disservice if you're trying to build a career. If you want to use this really obscure thing that no one's using, well, that's yeah. cool, but you might not get paid for it, right?
Yeah. Well, and I bring this up because last week, so it's within this past 7 days, PhoneGap, which was originally Cordova and then acquired by Adobe and made it PhoneGap. PhoneGap put out an announcement, or actually Adobe wow. did, saying that they're deprecating it, which is one of the worst things ever. And that was a stable environment but as opposed to doing native development or one of the other ones that, you know, Microsoft has started to push, like Ionic, it's now dead. It's still going to exist. You can still develop in it. But now if you're starting an application that is in PhoneGap, it's super risky to do. And I'm like passionate about PhoneGap. I love it. Like I've talked about it previously on other shows. And I think it's one of the best ways to create a responsive hybrid. It's really the only way to create a responsive hybrid application, meaning that it's for Android, iOS, desktop, OS X, Windows, as well as just in the browser. And now, you know, and that's a lot of my technology I built is around it. But now I'm like, oh, do I have to restart and build another platform? And I think that's why also like some of these like passionate languages that you have, it does go back to the stability and the like the likelihood that it's going to have longevity in the market. And we never really know. I mean, like I almost see it almost as like, you know, the difference between a browser coming out, like developing for IE 5.5, IE 6, IE 7, IE 8, and then eventually IE 10 came around, and then you could develop the same applications that you were doing in Chrome and Safari and not having so many like fallbacks out there. So maybe just a shift and change in the environment. And I still feel like companies aren't following that. But I'm getting off track about talking more about corporate identification of technology as opposed to learning the right ones.
Right. So what happens is right now, if you are somebody who wants to become a software developer, or you think that, okay, I don't know if I'm good enough, I don't know. So you're afraid. You try something, and then in order for you to, so you say, okay, I just want to be able to make simple full stack apps. It should have a few interactions, few pages, and then should save information in a database, and I should be able to bring it up, but it should be fairly modern. Okay, I want to start there. Even if you just wanted to start there, the number of new things that you have to learn, my goodness, just to build a page, it's not enough to just to know HTML. You have to know some CSS, and then CSS is its own thing, or you have to know some way of styling and figuring it out. And a little bit of JavaScript now is necessary for even simple apps. And then at this point, that's all you have. And then there's nothing in the back. But if you want to have a back end, if you just go with Ruby on Rails, for instance, Ruby on Rails is a very good example, because a lot of things come out of the box, right? Isn't that true, Warner? What you do is you use the templates and use their generators, and it will just generate the shell and you make some changes. Everything is by convention, which is good, which is what I like about Ruby on Rails, which is what I also like about Ember just wanted to say that I love Ember, but it's good. But even so, you still have to learn all of these gems. Like there are these 10 gems that you need to do for authentication. You need one for this, you need one for that. And any number of things can go wrong, because things are moving. This version is not supported. This version of Rails doesn't support this version of the gem, and this gem has this dependency on this other thing. Even then, you could get overwhelmed. You still haven't tackled the issue of building anything scalable, anything interactive. You're still not talking about React or Angular or, you know, anything else on the front end. This is just getting started. It's overwhelming. So wouldn't it be great if we had a way to just take these 10 steps, just very simple 10 things, and you will be able to repeat that process and build, get maybe 50% of the way, build something usable, and then add more things as you need it. But right now, the complexity is so much. Well, when I started, there was no complexity like that. You could do that. You could build a very simple app. You just needed to know two or three things.
But I still, like, when I teach classes, like, development 101 classes, it always starts with creating a single .html file and putting the proper HTML tags in there and just writing hello world. Step one, saving that, and then having some kind of server that you're putting the file on. That's just step one. If you can do that, you're miles ahead of anyone that's never written a website or knows anything about it. That on its own is actually literally amazing to think about. Something that you did on your computer, you put it on a server, and then it's accessible anywhere. So then once you have that, it's like, all right, so maybe it's an IP or some kind of namespace, add a domain to it. So then I go to kevinmaxsuperawesomewebpage.com and I see my hello world. That checks two boxes. Next thing, as you were saying, like add CSS. So add the link tag, to add some styling to it. And then once you do that, at least add something to it. Publish that out there. And then why that's important is you learn about the difference between absolute and relative paths. Add an image in there. Well, what does that mean to host an image? And then understanding like the rendering of an image inside there. These are all 101 things. And someone that's trying to even going to computer science, like it's amazing to hear about people that don't know about how I take the stuff that I've done on my computer and put it out there. And then from there, like we've talked about this, is like find a website or an application, try to replicate it, and then pick a language that you want to get out there. And I know a lot of times, like we were talking about like Rails being kind of the first one. In my experience and knowledge of people getting started, I always feel like the first backend language people use is PHP. And the reason why they do that is it's a very easy language to learn. It's also very complex in the latest versions from like PHP 5 and above. But with having PHP, why people do that is a lot of servers that exist out there from near free or free are all Apache PHP based. So to run a language that isn't PHP can add some complexity from managing the backend system on a remote server. So again, there's like this huge difference. Like I can build anything in any language on my machine, set that up, but the idea of making it be available, which is the end result of building something that people can see, you have to know about how that language gets out there. And I don't know, Warner, if you have like any, like, oh, I always try to think back from day one and like those aha moments that I had in having my first web pages out there that weren't like Angel Fire.
GeoCities.
Yeah, GeoCities.
I'm older, like, I guess.
No, those
like, same era. Tribe.
I remember the first day I got a website out there and then like the GeoCities and like, all of those that came out there and Angel Fire, whatnot. Where they handled all that for you. But those are actually primarily static HTML pages that all link together. And then it wasn't until I started getting into like some of the server side stuff, and it started with PHP at that time period. So I don't know if like, again, the head spot of first developer trying to get there. And then there's this sea of chaos of then what do I learn after that?
Yeah, I really like that picture you're building there, Kevin. It's easy for me to relate to, right? Building the first simple website. Oh, shoot, I remember when style sheets came out, right? And just being able to customize a hover was pretty cool at the time. I actually introduced that as a feature back when they were making proprietary stuff like font face. Yep. You could set the type of font in your HTML before Netscape supported it, and just because Microsoft decided to do so arbitrarily. Building websites was pretty tedious if you cared about browser compatibility back then. I think it's really easy to deep dive on the nuances of technology and overanalyze it, right? In fact, I often make the opposite argument where tech is simpler now. In that, certainly there's a lot to it, but we've abstracted a whole lot more, right? If you think of the OSI model, we're operating in layer 7 most of the time, 7 through 9 or 5 through 9, depending on how you like to look at it. So working on the application layer, even on the operation side, the infrastructure and operation side, those used to be the engineers who knew how everything worked and were able to break it down, like Kevin was describing. And just thinking of configuration management, where you could go to Puppet Forge, and this is kind of dated now, but you could go to Puppet Forge and download a module to spin up, a Puppet module to spin up whatever infrastructure you want. It might be a bad module, but you didn't have to know how to do it, and you wouldn't necessarily know it's bad. Now we have Helm charts. Like, there's even more abstraction now, thanks to all the Asterisk as a service, like IaaS, infrastructure as a service, all these solutions. Rails, you were exampling, Rails makes it incredibly easy to spin up a working application with a base level of knowledge, not knowing how things work. But even talking about all this is, I don't think it matters. It matters in the sense of you have to figure out how things work and apply it. And the areas where you're looking to grow as a professional, you should understand well and focus there. However, that raw skill comes if you apply yourself. And if you're new to a career, I don't care if you're like freshly minted CS or straight out of a boot camp. If you haven't found a way to develop more experience independent of working in a company, well, it's finding an environment that will help you. And that's one of the things I talk about most frequently with bootcamp students is there are a ton of shops in town here in Columbus. There are, I'd say maybe arbitrarily 40% of those higher entry level people, right? And of that 40%, there's probably like 10% who actually help mentor, support, and develop people new in their career. Most shops are just sink or swim. Sure, they might hire that 40%. Sure, they might hire you as a brand new developer and engineer, but you either figure it out or you don't, and you might not last if you don't figure it out. So early in a career, the shops that really support and help develop and have a mentoring culture and environments where it's safe to fail, and that will make so much more of an impact early in a career than deep diving in a man page.
Yeah. I completely agree with every single thing there. And the new thing that I've been telling folks and still trying to mentor as many people as possible, I'll give them access to a repo and have them look at like last night's commit. And then have them digest that and be like, well, why did you do it this way? As opposed to like the shadowing, because I feel like the shadowing kind of works, but what happens is someone's like over your shoulder and you're kind of walking and talking through it. And it's helpful. It's like watching a live tutorial on how to build something, but the application's so far, like unless you're starting on day zero of that and seeing it grow, the shadowing helps, but you don't get the full picture. But if you're looking at a Git commit and someone can read it and be like, why did you do it this way? Like, why did you make this change? Why did you add XYZ? I think that also helps you learn a few things. You learn about version control and like when to commit and how people commit. But then the changes in a project, especially if it's in the middle of a life cycle.
Yeah, I think this sink or swim mentality, I think this is pervasive. I've seen it and we all have seen it, right? So we expect certain number to swim and certain number to sink. We know that they're going to sink. And we account for that by hiring their replacements. So that's why we're constantly hiring, because we know we're going to get rid of the bottom X percent. I think this is where mentorship can fix that. And those people that fail, they're not necessarily bad. It's just they weren't guided, and it's not fair. So it's kind of luck or something else. Maybe they didn't have the guidance. Maybe they didn't get the right resources. Usually it's a matter of that. But we don't have the patience to deal with them. I think we could improve on that in the industry.
Yeah, I think it's really up to us. Like, people who have leadership responsibilities, people who run companies, own companies, whatever words you prefer, right? We love to talk about the pipeline problem, or the talent problem, I should say, in the engineering leadership circles. But if we're not working to curate talent and find ways to support people who might look a little differently than some of us, Those things are so important. It could be internship, it could be apprentice pro, whatever version you prefer. Build it, sustain it, and make it part of your organizational culture. And that's the only way we're going to stay ahead of the talent problem. And I love that Kevin brought up that billboard early on about this massive billboard, not standard dimensions for a billboard.
It was crazy big.
Like,
it
literally
was large. Yeah.
Massive. You see it from, you can't miss it from the freeway. It's the size of a skyscraper, right? Well, a story I tell more often is, well, I cover my meds, right? And when I joined the company, it was an early stage startup. And depending on the math, it was maybe 20 or 30 employees. When we sold to McKesson about 4 years, 3 years, 4 or 5 years later, we were over 500, right? So that's fast growth. And it was right around when we hit 100 headcount. And we always had exceptionally high standards for the people we brought on, both technically, culture fit, and just smart people, right? Not arbitrary qualifications, but some of the best folks I've ever worked with and will probably ever work with. And we were around 100 folks and hiring just as fast. I mean, just think, 4 years, 20, 30 to 500, right? I mean, do the math. And we didn't want to compromise standards. And that's when we decided to hire full-time remote. And we made a conscious effort and developed the capability and created the culture to support full-time remote workers. And now, thanks pandemic, we'll have a ton more folks doing that, which is great. Welcome to the party. And we should do that. Everyone should do that. It's a great idea. So we were able to keep the standards high and the hiring pace going thanks to that decision. And that billboard was a later stage. I don't know the exact number, but I want to say we're probably around 300 headcount then. And we were, again, encountering a challenge where we couldn't hire fast enough. And it was a conscious decision because we've been talking about it. We have a lot of Java and C# developers in Columbus. So we built a program literally to teach Java programmers Rails. And that's what the billboard was. It was advertising our program to do that. It was C# as well at the time, but for whatever reason, fuzzy memory, but I want to say we had more success with Java. But that's anecdotal, right? So just what I'm talking about here is how over time we changed tactics, but our strategy was always the same, to bring on the best and find ways to support them. And part of that was also developing talent.
So, hey, Warner, I have a question for you, because I know I've talked about this previously, because a lot of this has to go with the technology, and I love everything that you just brought up, but a lot of it has to do with the type of person too. So even though back to like the Rails, Node, or .NET, like I'm passionate about Rails, but the job is hiring for .NET. But I'm a passionate individual that can speak to it. And when I'm looking for someone to hire, I'm always looking for someone that's passionate, that may not know the technology, but is willing to go after and learn something new. I'm just kind of curious with that, like that crazy growth that you guys had, especially with everything that you do today, what are some like the, I guess, identifiable features or characteristics that you're looking for in an individual? And is it just limited to like the list of skill sets, knowledge of, or is it something more than that?
That's an interesting thought. I'll approach that from a couple different angles. I cover my meds, and this was built in pretty deeply into how we approached hiring. We didn't care about the specific technologies people knew. we cared that they were smart, added experience, were, smart is kind of arbitrary, right? But that they were able to build things. So our interview process focused on someone being able to apply themselves and build something. And we didn't specify what technology it was. I saw so many different things come out of our interview process.
That's awesome.
PHP, you name it, right? And sometimes folks would pick Ruby because they thought that's what we wanted. And we're like, we want you to show your best. And if you're not going to show your best using Ruby, that's probably not the right choice. And people didn't always believe us, unfortunately, but we did. So being able to do things, build things, apply themselves, get results. But that's kind of this scrappy startup mentality. That came from, well, frankly, some challenging hires by the founders early on. And I'm telling a version of the story I was told where people were hired that interviewed exceptionally well and then couldn't do anything. And if you're a small company, well, that's a big deal. So that was like the Cover My Meds. That was fundamental to the Cover My Meds hiring philosophy at the time. It could be completely different now, right? I'm telling stories from the past. Your question was really more about like, what matters, or what skills, what capabilities do I care about when hiring? And I take a very non-traditional approach when it comes to talent and team building and hiring. And above all, I want to understand the person. And I think it's really important to not create interview interactions that are arbitrarily pass fail. Like if your objective in an interview process is to prove you're smarter than the candidate, you're probably not being very effective in your goal of hiring people, assuming that is your goal.
So you think that goes on, like as an interviewer, you're like, I have to prove that I deserve to be here and that person deserves to be over there and I'm hiring. Is that how it works?
We've talked about this previously. Like I think a lot of times, especially for someone that is trying to get their career started, you're probably nervous at your first interview. And there's nothing more intimidating than this person trying to act like they know something better than you, or the interviewee or the interviewer kind of owning the interview, not giving the interviewee the opportunity to speak for themselves. So that is your space as someone that is a candidate. You make it your space. There's other tactics of like you sit back if you find yourself in that room with that person that is gloating, ask them questions about their gloatingness, pat them on the back, sugar it up. Maybe you'll get the job and you didn't even have to like talk about yourself. But end of day, a company like that is probably not going to, you're not going to have the result of having a mentor inside there. Those things that Warner was talking about earlier on. And you can get the job, but is it going to be a great job? If you're looking for a job and you need some money, yeah. Play the tactic of listening and letting them talk about themselves and walk away from it. But owning the conversation as a candidate is a great, that's your time to shine. And you don't want to be come off as cocky. We've talked about this before. If you don't know something, bring it up. Be like, I want to learn that. Especially in like that interview process. I had no idea that's how you guys did at Cover My Meds. It's super awesome. You let people do the technology that they want and let them talk about it. I think that's so cool. Like I always talk about like, if you don't know something, you don't have to pretend to know it. Mm-hmm. There's a difference between knowing what something is and then how to do it. And knowing that your limitations, maybe the skill set they're looking for, let your other skills, let your other attributes, let you as a candidate shine through in other various means.
Okay, so now we're talking about interviewing tactics. I'll tell you a little story. So many, many years ago, I went to San Diego for an interview. I really wanted to work in a startup company. I was much younger. And I went in there, and they flew me in, and there were lots of people. I think it was like a job seekers convention in that company, like dozens of people just in a hall, and we were all like lining up to do this, so kind of a mass interview. And they would have these huddles, and you'd go in there, and there's this person who was much younger than me is interviewing me, and he asked me the only interview that works in the West Coast, if you don't know, is a whiteboard interview. If you didn't know that, in the Midwest that's a little bit different. So he gave me a problem, an algorithm to solve. So my training is, as somebody who has interviewed in these types of things before, I know that the solution, getting to the answer, is not what they're looking for, not what they should be looking for. They should be looking for your approach. So they want to know, okay, how you think, how are you going to approach this problem? So the first question I ask is, more clarification on the question, and you know, just asking their opinion, just having this back and forth, and so driving this line by line. And I've done this for many years. And the guy was like, nope, not going to tell you anything. Just do it. Not going to talk. Just going to watch. See if you can do it right. So that happens. So that's not only that's intimidating. It's pointless. You know, that company, I knew that company would have been a disaster because of so many things I saw. I don't even want to talk about what's going on. And I mean, people were literally sleeping in the offices. There were like clothes being dried in the bathrooms. It was a mess. It was basically, I don't know, a dorm room or something. The entire office was weird. It can happen in the West Coast, trust me. But here, out in the Midwest, especially in Columbus, I see a lot of companies, they don't do that. There's very little whiteboard exercises. It's just actually typing in and programming, and they might give you a project, but a lot of times they make you do the whole day of coding, that kind of a thing. So that is intimidating. And Warner, I think I see your point that if they can make, if you say make a website that can do these things and use whatever technology you're comfortable with, and you judge them on what they made, and that's pretty good. It doesn't work for someone who may not have done that. So it may be a little intimidating if it's a whiteboard thing, or if you just, you know, people are watching you as you're typing and making a thing, or you have to give a presentation. Now, I think it works for an experienced person. Maybe I'm experienced in Java, and I just want to switch to Ruby, and you can use that criterion. I think that works. But for someone starting out, they just to make a complete project on their own, that may be a very intimidating thing. Wouldn't it be better if you just give them a piece of it? Like, this whole thing is done. There's this big hole here. See if you can fit that.
It's funny that adjust for people with less experience too, but I don't necessarily want to deconstruct a single interview process. But sorry, not to cut you off, Kevin.
No, I've done the West Coast interview process, and I at one point interviewed at Google. And they literally, this is not a joke, and like people, like I think it was brought up in like Silicon Valley, you can look these like interview questions up. They're meant to be confusing questions. They're supposed to be things that like throw you off because of the scenario. Like it makes me think back to when you're learning math like in elementary school and like the word problems. Where you're like, but why would there be like five ducks that need to do this? And it would like have some story associated with it. But like, I remember one of them, and I made it through like multiple rounds of interviews. And there was one that it was, and it's, you can actually look it up because it's a common one. It's something about like a blender and like how you would float to the top and not be blended up. And like some of the responses that people have put out there, like, are literally like, well, this would never happen. This is an unrealistic situation. And like people got a job based off of like a response like that. So it's like literally like sometimes these interview processes, like they're purely just to see how you think. And that's all it is. And that's what's really important. The only thing I disagree with, or I don't know if you were making a statement on this. I do like the whiteboard interviews, and I love seeing how someone will sketch out, because a lot of the problems that we're solving are high level and architectural, and you have to draw it out.
Yeah, I think I personally do prefer the whiteboard type of exercise over make this program in front of me kind of thing in Visual Studio or in your IDE and compile and make it build, because. Because that we're not really talking about process, we're talking about execution. And sometimes execution is something that is lacking in some people, or they could learn it. You could teach that. But process and thinking and approach, that's hard to teach. That's usually it's the temperament or aptitude, however you say it. But it also, I think it's easier because it's going to be interactive. So I personally like that. But you have to do it properly, right? Like in my example, this person was treating it like an actual program you type in, and not an exercise in design, right? Designing an algorithm interactively, because that's what you do in real life. If I'm given a problem, I'm not going to be able to go into my cave and come out with a solution. I'm going to go talk to people, and I'm going to iterate on it. And I may have tons of questions I'll ask. That's how we do it. I mean, we don't have all the answers.
So they were asking you literally to write out the code on the board with a Okay. Now I get it. Yeah.
It's a weird algorithm that I didn't know. Like, okay, do this. Or what kind of, some kind of sort, or I don't even remember what it was, many years ago. But it was something that either you know it or you don't know it. So what I do is if I'm doing it for real, I'm going to go and say, okay, I'm going to give you some examples of inputs and outputs. Okay, does this sound right? Is this? I'm trying to just draw some requirements out, right? Okay, if I put these inputs, are these valid? And then my understanding is that then this will be the output. So I create a sort of requirements for me on the side a little bit, and I know that this is what he's expecting. And then, of course, in real life, in good companies, which they want to see if you're checking for edge cases, negative, positive values, null values. That's what they want to see. Are you thinking about that, right? And then once you solve it in one way, then they're going to say, okay, well, this is good, but can you now improve the performance? This is a formula. I've been through this so many times.
The most important thing, sorry to cut you off there. The most important thing about that is if you find yourself in an interview like that, don't be defeated. And especially in this world where the COVID world, there are multiple layers of interviews that have to happen. There's a pool of people that are looking for jobs, and companies have the right to pick who they want. There's more candidates than ever available just due to the job market right now. And if you find yourself in one of those situations, that could probably have a very defeating feel to it. But I would just say, like, you know, move on and be like, that was weird. And like, try to shake it off, move on to the next one.
Yeah, that's a great thought. Like I built at least three interview processes end to end. And I took it super seriously and could tell you why I did every single thing. A step in that process. And some of those steps, some people wouldn't like, right? Sometimes it sucks to sit in front of a panel of interviewers. No, didn't necessarily do that, but sometimes, the whiteboard can really suck if you're live coding on a whiteboard, right? But architecture diagrams on a whiteboard can make a lot of sense. And going back to the working to understand someone, like none of those things should be pass fail, but there are a lot of bad interview processes out there. And I think as candidates, we can get stuck on that because, it can be high stakes, right? Especially if we want the job, and it can be frustrating to have to write yet another fake application to demonstrate my skills, especially if somebody has 10 plus years of experience, right? So the thing is, right, even a company with maybe not the best interview process, they want to hire people just as much as you might want the job. And well, be real about it. Don't stress, right? Develop interview skills are just as much a skill like anything else. I recommend people interview regularly. For a good portion of my career, I did. I interview, I practice it. Kevin practiced at Google, right? I interviewed with Google a couple times. I know what, yeah. But
I interviewed at Microsoft, Amazon. I interviewed on the West Coast extensively.
Did you guys ever fly out to San Francisco in a red eye to just find yourself in a meeting in a different time zone in a small little cubicle to do a video conference with someone that didn't have the time to come meet you? Been there, done that. And I don't know if that's like an intimidation tactic or something. It's just bizarre.
Wait, one of the team members based in Australia, right?
Yeah.
No, that's crazy. I think it's crazy because a lot of these companies, a lot of these tech companies that we like to work for because they do cool technology, they didn't like remote anything. Now it's all changing, by the way. They now that people are forced to work remotely and people are like, wait a minute, this is so much better.
Yeah.
What were we thinking before? So real estate prices should go down because nobody needs offices anymore. But okay, coming back to technology choices, because we have to wrap this up. We've been going for a long time. This is good stuff, but I'm sure that people are thinking, where are they going to get to technologies? So any recommendations? We could continue this later, but just to wrap up this episode, any final thoughts on what if I am right now? This is August 2020. I'm a new developer. I just want to start. Give me two or three things I should look at right now to just boost my career right now. Who's going to start?
I will reiterate an earlier point where I think it's less about the specific technologies and consider what you want to do. What are the leaders in the industry for what you want to do? What are they using? For some industries, it might be Java. For others, it might be Elixir. Go is some serious traction in some big tech companies, but it's not a majority of the industry, right? If you want to work in that company, knowing Go is an advantage. Think broadly. Becoming an expert is great. An expert software engineer, it's great. But if you're going to be a more effective professional, understand the different roles and functions and people in an organization and how they apply to your job. If you don't understand how systems engineering and cybersecurity applies to your work, you're less effective. So maybe that's long game, right? It can't hurt to know JavaScript, especially now that we're using it for backend. It's used in every front end, right? Pick a framework, but JavaScript is pretty universal if you want to pick a single tech.
Yeah, well, I agree with that, but if I'm listing off some technologies today, definitely not PhoneGap, but for... I like to build custom. I have my own CSS framework, but I'm saying if you're not someone that's hardcore CSS, like a CSS wizard or really interested in the design UI side of it, in August 2020, I would say material design. So what Google's put out for their component library is absolutely fantastic. Tailwind is an up-and-comer. It is a fantastic UI library. So Tailwind CSS is amazing. As much as I'm opposed to Bootstrap, I think learning Bootstrap because so many applications out there are written in Bootstrap. Becoming familiar with it, knowing what it is, very, very important. So those are from the CSS side. JavaScript side, can't echo enough, just learn ESX and above. Like, that is number one needed from JavaScript side. When it comes to frameworks or MVSTAR, MVC, React.js, incredibly important in today's market. Vue.js, incredibly important. I'll stop my list there because there's a lot more, but those are ones that I am constantly seeing. From the hybrid mobile application development side, Ionic, Flutter, absolutely huge. There's more job listings out there for Flutter overnight than I would have ever expected or known. Same thing with Ionic, and seems like Ionic's going to take over the phone gap side of it. Outside that, you know, if you're interested in native development, Xcode in general, downloading some example applications that are out there. And with Xcode, learning legacy, Objective-C, as well as Swift for today. If you're an Android guy, you have your own problems, so I'm not going to provide.
Not everybody has a Mac, Android. So those people are left out.
I know where your allegiance is.
But native development is huge. Native iOS and Android development, massively huge, still today. And I think that may shift over time. From back-end language, you know, this is all personal preference. You could ask a room full of developers, they would say a different thing. Hardcore Rails. Python is actually coming back and it's becoming more and more popular. So in today, August 2020, Rails, huge, at least in our market. Python becoming more and more important, and it's ever growing. And then outside that, you know, the traditional Java, .NET are still required and needed much in today's market. I know I'm forgetting a major library from a back-end standpoint that is really popular, but those are the ones that come to mind right now, and the job listings that I see out there when people reach out to me about, those are the listing of things.
The reality is there are jobs for every technology. There's nothing, even COBOL, you know, I recently dealing with people who do COBOL. It's a fact.
Make a lot of money doing it right now, too.
Yeah, so those applications are being phased out. Those are mainframe applications and so on. Those are systems that are being phased out. The jobs are being phased out, yes, but there are still jobs for them. But you could see some technologies are growing. You can just see them on the horizon. Like, this is a trajectory. Like, you could say that about, I would say a year ago, I would say that about React. I'm not sure if it's growing at that rate anymore. But if you're looking for front-end work, which means you make this website that acts and behaves nicely, fluidly. I don't want to use the word, I was going to say responsive, but that's something else. So, you know, it's kind of a nice little user interface if you wanted to make that type of application. Then what are the choices, right? You have Angular, you have Ember, you have Vue, you have React, and a few others. Everybody has their own choice. I've seen Angular being used in corporate worlds. A lot of corporations, if it's a big corporation, and if they are using a JavaScript framework, I'm going to bet that they're using Angular most of the time.
And probably 1.3 and not TypeScript, too.
Right, TypeScript, you can include that in any of the others because it transpiles it. You know, it makes making JavaScript, working in JavaScript much easier for us back-end developer, right? Because you have types, which is good. But here's the thing: you can do many things. If you just want to focus on Angular, you could become an Angular expert. Will you get a good job as an Angular expert? These days, I would say yes, because everything is remote. So you'll find somebody who really, really needs an Angular expert. It may hire you on a contract or may give you a job. Most likely, you can probably become an Angular consultant, and you could do that. And you could make a really good living doing that. And when Angular goes away and is replaced with something else, you could become that expert. That's a path that you can go deep into something. There's not a lot of companies that need a permanent Angular expert forever, right? So if you want to have a 20-year career with a big company, you probably don't want to specialize only in one thing. But if you wanted to be sort of independent and go from job to job, you could do that. Or you can become, you could become like Kevin. If I have a UI thing, I have an idea, you know, I know if I talk to Kevin, he's not, I won't say that he's an expert in this or versus that, but he would have touched a lot of things. He would have dealt with a lot of things. So his breadth of knowledge is going to be pretty good. So I will hire him to consult with me or to talk to me about user interfaces, user experiences, right? So that's sort of a general, specific to user experience, user interface, but still general enough that that you have worked with different things. You don't restrict yourself to one thing. And you don't need to know everything about this particular framework. You just need to know enough, and you know that the other thing will have something similar. You will figure it out. That I'll figure out kind of mentality. Then you can say, well, I really can't think in terms of user interfaces. You're not a user. You just like logic, and you want to be a back-end person. Maybe you just want to build services. And could you? So there's something called web services for people who don't know that those are these programs that live on the internet, and other programs can call those programs and get some information out of them, right? So there are many technologies that do that, but this is a thing. This is a legitimate thing. There is no user interface for humans, right? And you could be an expert in those RESTful services or just, you know, some kind of services, and you could just build these giant APIs. You could do that. Could you specialize in that? I'd say you can. But
yeah, for sure.
But again, it's very specific to one thing. Usually when you do that, you also do other things. Right. Right.
I feel like I'm going to be kicking myself if I don't call out Go, which has come up a few times, because I think that's one that is up and coming. It has been up and coming for many years. And I don't want to look back on this for like 3 years later and be like, I didn't mention Go. Go's another one to definitely look at, and it's super powerful.
So why is it good? I just want to know, because I have heard a lot of terms. I know a little bit about it, but people who are listening, they're like, I don't know what it is. Make me care about it.
The documentation that's out there and the ease of getting set up, and the power of it, it is a quick up and running. Right. So when we talk about things like Rails and, you know, you have the install your gems and you get going, goes like that. But there's like almost recipes that are out there to get started, and you can build things that are really on the back end, like your APIs, your services, super powerful for that. And it's just an amazing engine. So that's why I think it's becoming more and more popular. Right. It does a lot of like the hard solutions, something more said earlier, like technology is getting a little bit easier to build because these platforms have been grown and matured so much over time. And then the last one that I can't believe I didn't mention was Node. Node is major. You can't have a conversation about technology in an office today without Node coming up, no matter what platform you use today.
Node was losing traction, and then it started gaining it again.
Yeah.
I think it's
robust.
I think the fundamentals are good, as you're saying. If you know JavaScript, you already have the language.
And that's why I said JavaScript, right? Because there are shops right now that use it both for front end and back end.
For sure. And then the last thing I want to just say is there's this other alternative path. So we're saying everything that's available today, what's hot, what's important to learn, August 2020. There's a lot of legacy support. You know, I'm not a big Angular fan. I've done a lot of Angular, but there's jobs out there that are looking for someone that knows Angular 1, Angular 2. And so whenever you're learning new technology, you're usually learning the latest and greatest. Angular 1 versus modern day Angular, and I don't even know what version it is now, is 100% different. But there's still a need for someone to support those legacy apps. And you can make a career and a killing off of that. Right. And that seems silly to learn something. It's just like back to, I made a comment earlier about like IE7, IE6. I'm an expert a rare expert in developing for those. If it ever comes up, modern day or newer developers don't know how to support it. It would be a nightmare to do. I know it because I was there back in the day working in it, and I know all the issues with it. And following best practices of development today doesn't mean it's going to work for best practice of IE6. So supporting legacy technology and languages may seem like a waste of time, but I don't have numbers to it, but I would imagine there's a huge job market for it, because I know in previous jobs and places, that was something that we were always looking for, that I always forget about.
Yeah, I think these are a lot of these technologies that we talked about, for instance, COBOL and legacy support of any kind. You're going to have these sort of diminishing number of companies or projects that use it, but the value will go up exponentially. Yep. So if you could charge X dollars per hour in 2010, you could maybe charge 2X in 2020 for the same thing, because there's just not a lot of people who know this. That is true, but it's very hard to break into, right? You can't say, well, I want to be a COBOL developer and I have never programmed before. I want to start with COBOL and be an expert. Usually that programming, it's COBOL is not the hardest thing. I think it's just learning the environment, the constrictions and restrictions under which it works. And you really need to be deeply steeped in the mainframe, the way it works, right? It is not like a web server. It's different. And similarly, if you're working in, I did a project supporting a mobile IE. I think it was 5.5. And it was on a handheld scanner device. It was like 2 inches across. The website had to run in that. So, yeah, it was a mess. Nothing worked. Right. So I learned a lot about, where do I get polyfills for every little thing? I grew to appreciate Mozilla Developer Network. Right. I go there and I pick up my polyfill. I know why. And I stopped caring. I was like, I don't care. I'll write my code. When it doesn't work, I'll go get a polyfill. it's kind of lazy. But the point of it is, I had to work on it, so I did. But I'm not going to start off looking at that. But if you happen to be somebody who knows something, you could double down on that. That's absolutely true, Kevin. I think this is a great point. If you just happen to work in a legacy technology that nobody uses, you think that the world is moving away from, you could double down on that instead of moving away from it and build on that. That's an option if you really want to do it. Mm-hmm. And one more thing I wanted to mention is very important. And we never talk about it at conferences. We never talk about when, you know, techies talk, because we're not excited about it. But the fact is, that another segment of programming, software development, technology exists very successfully and pays very well. And nobody seems to talk about it. Is those specialized applications that have a development environment inside of them. For instance, you could work inside Salesforce. Salesforce is a platform. Mm-hmm. It's an application with a platform. You can do some programming, and it's very lucrative. I worked in Salesforce for a number of years. I know that there's huge demand, and some of it is actual real programming. A lot of it is it's a little bit of this, a little bit of that, right? You could build a user interface. You could build an enterprise plugin, this and that. There are lots of things to do there. And there's lots of money. Similarly, there's SAP, Siebel, all these types of things. You never go to a conference and say, let me talk to you about development in, you know, Siebel or SharePoint or that kind of thing. It's like, it's not exciting. We don't want to talk about it. But the fact is, there are lots and lots of jobs there.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's kind of risky, honestly, specializing in tech. I used to know a lot of Cold Fusion folks, right? There's a few of those shops left. I ran across one the other day. I'm like, you're using what? Why?
Flash devs.
Flash. That's sad.
Maybe enroll first over specific tech. I mean, all your points are legitimate. I wouldn't offer counterpoint, but getting too focused on a single thing is risky if that thing goes away. Now, COBOL, right? The reason why you make a lot of money in it is because you have enterprise companies who rely on it for core business functions, and they're still running it, and they need it to run. So the three people left who do COBOL get paid a lot. Now, it wouldn't be a great place to start a career, but if you happen to have that experience, it's a pretty solid thing to work in right now. So there's all sorts of anecdotal stories about specializations in specific technologies, but somebody can be an expert. You might be a front-end expert, and maybe you're better at front-end over back-end, or a back-end expert, right? Which maybe you started in a single technology, and maybe it was Angular, maybe it was React, if it was front-end, if we're talking present time.
Right.
But if you stay in that for 10 years, I think that's a disservice. Like, maybe you can keep that expertise, but if you're not growing, at least as a front-end developer, and learning and broadening your skills even as an expert in that specific area, you're probably going to hold yourself back long-term.
Yeah, and for front-end, I think this doesn't even work. You know how fast it changes. The whole web changes. JavaScript changes. Every year there's a new Java.
And I'd say the same thing about back-end, too. I know some great Perl developers, but I can't name any Perl shops anymore, right?
I think that's something to do with Perl. It's changing so much. They're just completely up and, oh, we're going to start over. I think that's what happened with Perl. But also, there's alternatives now, right? For instance, there's Python. If you had to pick Python over, you had to choose between Python and Perl in a new project. There's not much. I'm biased, but I personally don't think you gain much from Perl over Python. I have to have an opinion. If you've been in this industry long enough, you can't. Like, it's like eating candy. You like either you like chocolate or you don't. You can't be like, eh, I you know. You either like it or
I
you
like whiskey. Well, I can... Not so much candy.
No, I mean, the point is that you're going to have an opinion. And my opinion doesn't have to be correct, but I should have an opinion. And you have an opinion, and you have an opinion. So we all have our opinions. And when somebody's starting out, somebody says, for instance, oh, PHP is great because, you know, you could build your websites very fast and it's easy to understand. It's very easy to understand. Everything is right there in front of you. But they may hate it. Mm-hmm. That's fine because you can find something else. But I think to Warner's point, if you are able to make it work for you, if you're doing PHP or anything else, and you can actually take a concept and take it to completion, then that there's value there, and you will learn all of the concepts that go into. For instance, we're just talking about web development. That's not the only type of development, but even in this case, you know. What a web page looks like, what a request response communication looks like, what do you need to send in a form, and how do you deal with it? So this has been a great discussion. We are a little bit over time, so we're just going to wrap up here. Let's give our final thoughts and anything you want to say about how to get in touch with you.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's been super cool hanging out with you. Great conversation, right? I think there are so many insightful things. If somebody's new in a career and applies themselves and works in areas that they're passionate about, it's hard to go wrong, I think. Always welcome conversation. I'm available at Warner, WARNER, at gammaforce.io, as well as all the usual spots, be it LinkedIn, what have you. Always welcome conversation. Doing lots in the community between a nonprofit I founded, Tech Community Coalition, and stuff like that. We're always looking for speakers, collaborators,
thank you,
and,
Warner,
in different areas.
Kevin.
So don't hesitate to reach out. And thank you both. Been a pleasure.
As always, this is fun. Appreciate it. And I think the common theme where it's been said so many times, like passion, I think closing thoughts are really just for people to find their passion, whatever that may be, and may not be the best career opportunity. But if you're learning, find that thing that you're passionate about and then apply it to other job opportunities that are out there. And I'm available on almost all networks under Nice Transition. So I'm easily found. And that's pretty much it. But thanks again for having me. Warner, it was fantastic to have you join today. It's fantastic.
It was so good to have you, Kevin and Warner, and all of you who are watching and listening. If you want to send me your questions or ask questions for these gentlemen, send it to me. You can email me at us@mentoringdevelopers.com. us@mentoringdevelopers.com. It's easy. And if you wanted to see this podcast, or if you want to listen to this podcast on the internet or iTunes and Spotify and all that, you can type mentoringdevelopers.com/episode, the number, whatever episode it is, or any of the previous episodes. And we're going to have lots more. We're going to have Kevin on. We're going to have all these people on. And I really appreciate you being here. And I'll see you guys later.
For show notes and transcripts, visit us at mentoringdevelopers.com.